From the studios of WRPI in Troy, New York, you're listening to Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, good technology, and bad intentions. What happens when you mix them all together? And we're like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host for the next 2 hours as we explore this world of the high tech and, of course, beat up Big Brother as much as we can. This is episode 18 of Little Brother, dated 31st of August, 2001. Stay tuned. Little Brother is just around the corner and completely out of breath. For some reason, this particular evening, this place has turned out to be the chaos capital of the world. However, we've got our stuff pulled together finally, and I think we're ready to begin. My name is Chuck Ritter. We have some guests in the studio tonight. Phil is here. Say hello, Phil.
Hello.
Lil is here. Say hello, Lil.
Hi.
And, of course, we have a new person in the studio tonight, Pete Fizette. Say hi, Pete.
Hi, Pete.
Let me bring your mic up a little bit because you're a little bit low there. Say it again.
Hi, Pete.
Okay. And what we're going to do is start by telling you that the opinions and views expressed on this program are strictly those of the participants, not necessarily those of the WRPI staff or management, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, or the Rensselaer Student Union, or anybody else who may, for whatever reason, attempt to claim them. Of course, you are perfectly welcome to agree with them if you feel so inclined. We're also going to take your phone calls tonight. The phone number here at WRPI is area code 518-276-6248. So let's get this thing started. As usual, we're going to start with the stuff that I have stumbled across on the Risks Digest, on comp.risks news group. Where do I want to even start here? Like I said, this is the chaos capital of the world right now. Let me just bring the music up for a moment while I figure out what I'm doing. Item we have up comes from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Broward County officials, considering the $20 million purchase of a touchscreen voting system, want students to try to tamper with the computers during a mock election. One of the biggest concerns raised is whether or not there is a potential for computer abuse, and we really need to see how foolproof or tamper-proof the system is, said County Commission Chairman John Rodstrom. If there's a problem, it'll happen now or later, and some of these kids are pretty smart. Well, the risks are legion and well-documented. It's too bad that Florida officials are relying on students to reproduce them. But hey, one of them may learn the value of reading the literature instead of reinventing it. And if somebody with very little experience can demonstrate the lack of security, that might impress some of the folks who are either supremely gullible or counting on opportunities for fraud. But please remember that some of the most insidious, riskful vulnerabilities are those that can be exploited by insiders in the development and maintenance process. Once again, recognize that all of the touchscreen systems today have absolutely no independent voter-verified audit records, such as a printed ballot image that can be stored in ballot boxes and guarded at least as well as paper ballots are today, whether punched card or optically scanned. Thus, there's no reasonable guarantee in a touchscreen system that your ballot is cast is actually equivalent to the ballot that is counted. This could be remedied relatively easily as recommended. Let's see here. This item was submitted by Chris Smith. Actually, the editor of Comparist is pointing out this is three parts sent separately and merged into one item. It says, the following news reports from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation cover a Saturday evening incident in the Welland Canal in southern Ontario near the border with Buffalo when a lift bridge was lowered too soon, shearing off the top of the wheelhouse of a 700-foot bulk freighter.
That's funny.
I suppose it is, actually, when it comes to it. I'll tell a story on that one in a minute. Oh, shoot. I lost my place. Damage to the out-of-control freighter followed, first in collision with the canal and then with a fire breaking out on board. The fire flared up again briefly on Monday morning. At least one news report stated that the bridge is under remote control with bridge cameras monitored from a remote control location. For now, the clear risk is not having a work fallback to deal with situations that are never supposed to happen. We await news of what went wrong. We hope something did actually go wrong that gave rise to the accident. Let's see. Just to make... This is the second part of the item. It says, just to make me look silly, I'm certain the report is now that the bridge has run directly from a command cabin on the lift section itself. I checked the CBC video stream, and they did explicitly say the bridge was under remote control. This makes a lot of sense, especially from the point of view of avoiding accidents, which leaves us with an open risks question to be checked later when it is known what caused the collision. The third part says, as the reference newspaper article makes clear, the Welland Canal Bridge that collided with the freighter Windock was not remotely operated bridge. This contradicts authoritatively the statement earlier in Canadian Broadcasting Corporation report that the bridge was remotely controlled. Only one of the eight lift bridges across the canal is remotely controlled. The rest are staffed 24 hours a day during the shipping season, which I think is decidedly
now,
a good thing.
You said that they had cameras. Is there any way of getting footage of this mishap?
Well, you know, they mentioned a CBC video stream, so I'm assuming... I would have to assume that they must have got that from the canal authority, because... I just can't picture a CBC news crew sitting there waiting for a canal to collide with the bridge.
I thought the funniest part of the article is when they said the bridge collided with the ship.
Yeah, the bridge collided with the.
Right.
Well, I don't know if you've seen these. I don't know if you've seen these lift bridges that they have out in Western New York.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Okay. So yeah, I know it sounds really weird that the bridge collided with the ship rather than the other way around, but. It's definitely a distinct possibility. Let's see. I did have another item here. I did have another section here of items from Risks Digest. It looks like Lil has them. So if you want to pick up an article there and run it, let's go.
Oh, yeah. I have here an article on Kaiser Permanente. It's kind of a situation similar to Eli Lilly, except I guess the information hasn't actually leaked yet. It says here, there's a self-service section on the Kaiser Permanente, an HMO, website at www.kaiserpermanente.org that allows you to notify them of a change of address. In bold letters next to the submit button, it claims, your information is secure. Sounds good. Checking view source showed the form was being submitted over SSL. Okay, well, let's submit the information. A few minutes later, an email arrives. No encryption. Ooh, it contains a verbatim copy of the personal information I typed into the form. So much for your information is secure. Why bother breaking SSL flows when you can just watch the email?
Yeah, that story sounds very similar to another one that you had on a couple shows ago.
Oh, about the doctor's office.
Yeah, where it was submitted via just email.
Well, you know, there's always a bunch of stupidity going on with regard to an assumption that email is secure, and of course it is not. It never has been. And actually, I have a story right here that covers on that very front. Let's see here. This was from the Register. You can find the Register is at www.theregister.co.uk. It says, the FBI investigation that led to last week's arrest of former Air Force sergeant on espionage charges had more in common with a modern internet hacker hunt than a John le Carre novel, according to court records. Brian P. Reagan, I wonder if he's related. Anyway, Brian P. Reagan, 38, was arrested Thursday at Washington International Airport while boarding a Lufthansa flight to Zurich, Switzerland. He's charged with conspiracy to commit espionage for allegedly passing classified satellite photos and secret documents to an unnamed foreign nation, which is called Country A in the court filings, identified in the Washington Post as being Libya. Reagan had been posted at the Super Secret National Reconnaissance Office, or NRO, in Virginia, according to the Defense Department. That's the Defense Department organization responsible for building and controlling the U.S. network of orbiting reconnaissance satellites. According to a 19-page FBI affidavit filed in the case last week, which relies much on an unidentified reliable source information, Reagan began his abortive espionage career in August of 2000, shortly after retiring from military service. He allegedly introduced himself to Country A by passing it a set of overhead satellite photos as well as a CIA intelligence report, two pages from a classified CIA newsletter, and other documents. At the same time, Reagan, a former system administrator, gave his would-be handlers a number of encrypted messages and a plain text message written in English. The initial unencrypted message appears to be an introductory letter containing instructions to prevent detection of the messages by the U.S. government, according to the affidavit. Okay, I'm going to stop there. I might bring the rest of the story to you later, but I'm going to stop right there. He sent a plain text email, unencrypted that is, to a foreign nation to offer to spy for them. What is wrong with this picture?
You probably got 50 answers.
Show me your papers. Is that the satellite in your suitcase?
Yeah, right? Anyway, that people trust email a little bit too much to be secure.
All right, well, I have another story from the Risks Digest here. This one's kind of amusing for anybody that's ever had to deal with automated customer service. This is from Sharon Mick. Our long-distance service is plain vanilla AT&T service. Long-distance charges appear on our local Ameritech phone bill. This past month, we got a bill showing charges for the AT&T One rate plan for which we had not signed up. We also have an anti-slamming policy signed and on file. So I called Ameritech. After negotiating their automated attendant, hell, I was told that there was nothing they could do. I needed to call AT&T. At AT&T, more automated attendant help. When I got the rep on the line, I give her my phone number and name and explain the problem. She tells me that she can't help me because our phone number has someone else's name on it. And neither I nor my husband is that person, whose name she will not reveal. I guess privacy does matter. And she can't give me to a supervisor. Thank you for calling AT&T. Just a note, we've lived at our house for 7 years and always had the same area code and phone number. Apparently, the AT&T record had been changed in February of this year, and our phone number was now associated with a different name and address. If there was a notation of who authorized the change, she sure didn't tell me. After all, it wasn't my phone line. Back to Ameritech. Their rep confirmed that our line was indeed our line, in my name, at our address. I was fortunate. This rep had initiative. Once I explained the situation, though it took a couple of repeats, he put me on hold and called AT&T to set up a conference call. Things almost fell apart at this point because Ameritech reps have a pretty strict time limit on their calls. We got an AT&T rep on the phone at just about the limit. He went on to explain to the AT&T rep that my line was really my line. She wasn't buying it. After all, her computer must be right, but finally, grudgingly, agreed to amend her record, noting his ID, info, etc. as justification. Finally, we could get to the point of removing the unwanted calling plan. Mission accomplished. One last detail. The calling plan cost a certain amount, but also involved a credit. Because the plan changed, because the plan changes tariffs and long-distance rates, our long-distance usage, minimal, had been billed at the wrong rate, and neither of the reps could tell me what we actually owed.
Oh, excuse me, ma'am. Can you please hold while I transfer you to a computer?
I wonder if they billed her for the call that she made to get it fixed.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't be too terribly surprised at this point. You mean for the customer service time?
Yeah.
I don't know.
You have to pay to call. I don't even remember what it's called at this point. It's changed hands so many times. It's Verizon. You have to pay to call them. They don't have a toll free number that you call.
Yeah, they do.
Do they?
Yeah, yeah. The,
wow,
they
I
have
found.
A. No, it's toll free. The 890 exchange is toll free.
Mm.
The 890 exchange also spans all of New York State's area codes.
Well, I'll be dipped in fries.
I'm surprised Verizon doesn't have like one of those Caribbean numbers where you get charged $49.99 a minute.
Yeah, really. Yeah, really. You have one?
No, actually, I'm still going over it. I'm sorry.
Okay, that's okay. It just looked like you were interested in running that one. So I'll run this one. This is caption on this. This is also out of the Risks Digest. Caption on this one is "Risks to Lose Sleep Over," and was submitted by Mike Nell. He says, while staying in a German Luth, yeah, I need to get my tang untangled here. While staying in a German youth hostel a couple of weeks ago, I was woken up at midnight by someone telling me I hadn't paid to stay that night, so I'd have to pay them 33 Deutschmarks or leave. I said something along the lines of, ugh, having been freshly awakened. No, I've definitely paid in advance for two nights. This is the second night. No, they said, you've only paid for one. Okay, look, I've got a receipt. Can I come downstairs and sort this out? Sure thing, they said. Better be down in 5 minutes at the most. So I put some clothes on, found the receipt in my wallet, and presented it at the front desk. Sure enough, it was a receipt for two times 33 Deutschmarks, or 66 Deutschmarks. Two nights, all paid. But no, they said, look, the departure date printed on your receipt shows you've only paid for one night, and the computer agrees, so you'll have to pay us 33 Deutschmarks for tonight, or leave. By now, I was beginning to wonder whether I was hallucinating. My receipt for two nights wasn't being accepted as such. Why not? At about this point, I stopped speaking German and switched to English, because arguing in a foreign language when you've been awake for 2 minutes and you're starting to doubt your sanity anyway is tricky. After a bit more arguing of I've paid, no you haven't sort, and a lot more of fiddling around with the registration computer, the problem was solved. Yes, I'd paid two nights at 33 Deutschmarks each, but this had been recorded in the booking system as two persons for one night, not one person for two nights. So I'd been flagged as having departed. This also explains the discrepancy in the departure date on the receipt. Since everything was now in order, I was graciously permitted to return to my dorm and go back to sleep. The risks here are obvious. The computer's not always right when it's been given the wrong information in the first place. Garbage in, garbage out. This was, however, the first time I've encountered anyone not believing the evidence of their own eyes, my receipt for two paid nights, and my key card with the correct departure date written on it, because the computer didn't agree with it. I'd also mention the risks of waking me up in the middle of the night just to annoy me like this, but they're pretty obvious, too. Let's see, have an item here from Dylan Northrup. He writes, an infinite number of monkeys in the guise of a risks contributor wrote, let's see, okay, this was in regards to, this was one I read a couple of weeks ago, I think, about AT&T's customer service representatives having access to a list of all usernames and passwords in the system. This writer is saying that it's not surprising that when working for another major ISP, the database for their users also had passwords available for each customer and were used by customer service as well as system administrators to help diagnose specific problems with customers. When working with a problem that affects a specific customer, sometimes the best way to reproduce it from the other end is to use the service as the customer. That the customer service representative asked for your password is unique, or at least questionable. Our user base was instructed never to give that information over the phone, and that customer service reps would be able to access that information if necessary. Got another one?
Or maybe Pete.
I have here the story about that woman in customs, but I think it might be a repeat of the story you read last time.
Oh, it is. It's an exact repeat. Why don't we hang on to that one for a little bit? We're going to recap that one in a.
That's a highly enjoyable story, so we want time to.
Oh, it really is.
Devote to it.
It really is. It's got nothing to do with technology, but it does have a lot to do with telling on Big Brother, and certainly it generated a lot of interest last week. So we will recap that one.
You know, it's interesting. I was I was on one website once, and
only once.
Well, no, this is a particular website, and they had instructions for writing to the FBI and just seeing if you actually have a file. And having this radio program, I'd be curious to find out if you do have a file, if the government does have a file on you.
Well, I actually,
I do expect that they have a file on me, but I will refrain from discussing what content it may contain.
Yeah, we need a website to tell you how thick the file is.
Right.
Hey, now that would actually be very useful.
Way? What color is it?
I do know the FCC, not the FCC, the FBI had a rather intriguing file on John Lennon. It was all part of their COINTELPRO project back in the late 60s and early 70s. And I know they had there was a New York Times reporter that finally extracted it from them under the Freedom of Information Act. It took some convincing to get them to actually bring it out. But the thing of it is that the FBI actually tagged him as an incredibly dangerous individual. They didn't obviously take into account his personality, but they considered him dangerous because I'm sure that if he had said to do something, that a lot of people would have done just exactly that.
Oh, no. All those girls could do was stand there and scream. They were harmless.
Well, that may have been true.
They didn't have the intellectual capacity to take in what he might tell them to do, to run out and go do it.
Hey, my mom was a Beatles fan.
Yeah, so was mine.
Yeah, well, the thing of it is, though, yours was a Beatles fan in the early part of the...
that was the screaming years.
Yeah, the screaming years of the Beatles, the bubblegum pop years of the Beatles.
Yeah, well, I'm sure Phil's mom was during the bubblegum pop years, too, probably.
The She Loves You, Yeah, Yeah, stage of it.
Yeah.
You know, but anyway. Okay, I think, do you have one you want to run with?
Sure. It's an interesting perspective on what's going to happen. This is from InfoWorld, and it's written by Ephraim Schwartz, and it says it's about an underground movement. An underground movement to deploy free wireless access zones in metropolitan areas is taking hold. If it turns out to be successful, wireless network operators may be fighting against a grounds-up movement that could undermine their multi-billion dollar campaign to offer next-generation 3G wireless services in metro areas. The movement, called by some the parasitic grid and by others more simply the free metro wireless data network, has already installed itself in New York, San Francisco, Seattle, Aspen, Colorado, Portland, Oregon, British Columbia, and London. Quote, if you have enough of these in place and spread out effectively, you have created what is referred to as a parasitic grid, a.k.a. multiple wireless served areas. If you have enough, you would have connectivity nationally, said J.R. Bibb, a technology advisor to Shell Oil in Houston. Bibb was offering his own opinion as a technologist and was not speaking for Shell Oil. What is it all about? Is the use of a technology called 802.11b, a standard for wireless Ethernet that works on an unlicensed portion of the wireless spectrum at a performance of 11 megabits per second. It is, in fact, 5 times faster than the best speeds promised by all major wireless network operators for 3G services. The major goal is to build up the 802.11b infrastructure inside the city. If you have a home that is connected to the Internet, for example, I use your connection and you can use mine, said Matt Westervelt, one of the originators of what he likes to call a symbiotic grid rather than a parasitic one. Westervelt talks about a network of volunteers deploying at their own expense a wireless access point on the outside of their home, or at worst, at a window, with the access point connected to a volunteer's PC. The access point, as the name implies, gives users within range of any one of these access points who has a wireless LAN card in their mobile device a connection to any other device or node on the same LAN. Once a more or less complete grid of access points are put up around a city, grid participants could connect in the LAN to access numerous services, including a free alternative to fee-based cellular networks. Voice services over 802.11b are typically referred to as VoIP, V-O-I-P. And I could go on. This is quite extensive. And, you know, this is going to be happening locally in homes, and it's going to be coming pretty, you know, commonly available. So I don't know why they would call it a parasitic grid unless they think that it doesn't add to features that people will...
Now, what do you think the advantages of wireless are over, say, cable modem or some of the other high-speed online services that we have now?
Well, I mean, for me or for the average user?
Just for the average user.
Well, I think mobility. So, you know, you could take your computer that you have a wireless connection to in your house and go to my house,
mm-hmm,
and use my wireless connection, and you'd still, you know, you wouldn't have to plug in. You would be able to move around seamlessly from place to place.
Do you think there'd be security issues since you're
Yeah, so you're always connected wireless.
One of the problems with the 802.11b recently is that there's been a number of breaks in their security system.
Mm-hmm.
But it was never really intended to be a foolproof. There is no security system that can't be broken anyway, but this particular one was broken fairly easily in a year or so. And they think that it could be broken in 15 minutes with the right kind of process. But the point is, you don't use the basic security feature, you add your own layer of security onto it so that there isn't any a predetermined security break that they can use.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd use a VPN over that wireless network. You keep the wireless network outside of your firewall and use it that way. You're much safer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the thing I find interesting about it is certainly right off the face of it, it's going to be far simpler to provision than trying to get a T1 put in or DSL or even a cable modem. And because of the fact that, for one thing, you don't have to deal with an outside entity to set it up, except for whoever may happen to be at the other end of the link. In the case of trying to get a T1 provision, you have to deal with the phone company, you have to deal with your ISP, and maybe you've got to deal with multiple phone companies, depending on where your ISP is located. And it takes months to make anything happen. It's with DSL, you have to fight with the phone company and fight with the phone company. And, oh, yeah, then you got to fight with the phone company. I know I went through a 5.5-month battle over DSL myself before finally saying, forget this. And, obviously, my words were quite a bit stronger than that, but... being that we're on FCC-regulated radio, I have
yes,
to
Yes, I believe your
control.
Exact words were VerizonEatsPoop.com.
I've been having problems with Roadrunner lately. Last night, the cable light just went out, and nothing works. The cable TV doesn't work. The internet connection doesn't work. And I called the company, and they said that they're having a problem with it, and it should just correct itself, but it's been about 24 hours, and it still hasn't. And just five blocks down the road... at work, their connection was up and running fine.
And I think that brings out a point, is that when the term of a wireless network is called parasitic, it's completely wrong, because actually you will have these outages and people become dependent for whatever information they allow themselves to become dependent on these connections. And these wireless connections add a secondary connection that if the Roadrunner or the Verizon link went down, you'd have this alternate connection to get the information that you needed that maybe someday your life would depend on.
Right, like your porn.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that the reason why they're referring to it as parasitic, I think the question whether it's parasitic or supplemental depends on whether you are from the buyer's point of view or from the seller's point of view. Obviously, to the buyer, this is a great boon. This is something that you can set up fairly cheaply. And when you are the seller, you're going to dread anything that could cut into your bottom line. So, what are your opinions out there in the listening audience? If you would like to contribute your opinion, the phone number here is area code 518-276-6248, and we'd like to hear from you. So while we're waiting for the phones to start ringing off the hook.
I was just saying, if we take it to the extreme, someday Verizon will be buying services from you.
I would like that. And then they could start their own website, ChuckRitterEatsPoop.com.
You could read their email.
I tell you what, you got a phone book here?
Might have a phone book here somewhere.
I want to take my original idea and just pick a name at random and call them up and just bring them on the air and just talk to them about technology.
I don't know.
And what their opinions and viewpoints are.
I don't know about that idea. We'll discuss that one offline at some point.
I think what it's going to do is generate a lot of good competition. That there's going to be better services and fairer prices, and it's going to stabilize a lot of technology that otherwise.
Till they figure a way around it. Till they figure out a way to charge you for that too.
Well, yeah, but that's just the thing. How are they going to do it? I mean, we're talking about radios that have got a range of about.
300 yards, I believe it is. I haven't played with it much myself.
Well, there's antennas that you can get that'll go about 2 kilometers.
Right, and when you do that, you're firing it off in such a tight little beam that you've got to be in just exactly the right place if you're going to intercept it in any way. So they got their work cut out for them if they actually intend to charge for this.
One of the best advantages of having 2 connections is that you'll be able to check up on your security. On the one line, you have a security, a VPN or some kind of security technology that you're using that you're trusting. But you don't know, because of that single thread, if it's being tapped into or changed. Whereas if you had multi-threads, if you had different ways out of your host or your computer, you could check up on your security to make sure it hasn't been broken on the other side at your destination, in between here and there. So that's one of the absolute critical requirements of having a second connection to the net. That might ultimately be slower. You might end up buying a faster connection for Verizon, but you'll have a public service network that, you know, is owned by the community that can do the security checking.
Well, the problem with my setup at home, I use Roadrunner as the primary and only internet provider, but I opted for Roadrunner because we don't have a phone line coming into the house. We were using the internet to place phone calls. So when the internet's down, so is our phone line. And I tried calling the cable company, and they just basically said, well, are you in front of the computer? Oh, never mind. I'm not going to go into the whole story right now.
Oh, come on. I was getting so interested.
No, I have to go to the bathroom.
Got any more important announcements?
Mother Nature calls. Mother Nature calling.
That's right.
Well, I guess...
What's he going to do? We don't have Netaphone to call her back.
We need to buy one of those bedpans from Rite Aid.
I
can just bring it right here in the studio. Right. I don't have to get up.
A wireless bathroom.
That's right.
the next great technology break.
That's right.
Brought to you by Little Brother.
We can mark.
Sure, pin it on me. Okay,
Little Brother Porta Potty.
Just, I didn't want to stop here because there's one important thing. Anybody who thinks that they have an encrypted email or a method to encrypt something, that may be true for now, but if it's stored for maybe a year or two, the method to break that encryption will come around, and then they'll pull that encrypted note off the shelf and decrypt it. So, you know, encryption is just a word, basically.
Put simply, what man can lock, man can unlock.
There you go.
I think it's time to take a quick break. We will be back in a couple of minutes. You're listening to Little Brother on 91.5 FM WRPI Troy.
Visit you tonight. Cloudy visions of the past and future, throwing shadows on your inner life. Sun is going down on the city. Skyline turns a pale shade of blue. Up and down it seems we run forever. Yeah, which one do you choose?
To 91.5 FM WRPI Troy. The show is Little Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter. I'm here with Phil and with Pete. And Lil seems to have stepped out of the room for a moment, but I'm sure she'll be back. And we need to take a brief moment for a public service announcement. So, parenting is a rewarding experience, but it can also be a challenging one. The Child Welfare League of America has some positive parenting tips to build your young child's self-confidence and self-worth. Always remember to treat your child as an individual. Avoid comparing him or her to other children. Take time to talk with and listen to your child. Make sure your child knows you enjoy this special time together. Your children want to please you. Show them that you approve of their efforts with words, smiles, and hugs. Compliment, praise, and encourage your child. When things go wrong, try to focus on the unacceptable behavior, not on the child. Appreciate the value of play in your child's life. It's vital to development, learning, and happiness. And most importantly, take care of yourself. To receive a free packet of positive parenting materials, including a poster, picture frame, and magnet and booklet, please call 1-800-407-6273 or visit www.cwla.org. And we're back.
That last announcement reminded me, I was at Rite Aid and they have those little pamphlets, Stop Bedwetting. So I picked one up and put my mother's address and mailed it out.
Oh, dear.
So she should be getting something in the mail soon.
That's a good son.
Okay. Yes, but see, when she receives it, she'll focus on your negative behavior and not on what an awful son you are.
Okay, so now that we have Phil's personal issues out of the way, for the moment.
Just that one anyway.
Yes. Well, yeah, that one's out of the way.
Oh, I have many.
I'll take your word for it. We don't need to dive into all of them. We have just a quick follow-up on a couple of stories that we've been covering right along here. The first one I want to talk about briefly is Dmitry Skilarov. Dmitry Skilarov is a Russian computer programmer. He works for Elcomsoft in Moscow. And recently, on a visit to the U.S. to give a speech at a hacker convention, he was arrested for violation of the communication... I'm sorry, let me try that one again. Of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. I keep confusing it with the Communications Decency Act of a few years back, which was another similarly heinous piece of legislation. At any rate, in Skilarov's case, it's my opinion that he shouldn't have been arrested in this country for what is a crime in this country but is not a crime in the country where said activity, not a crime, had taken place. But at any rate, He's still stuck in Northern California at this point in time. He was indicted on, on August 28th. And, the indictment alleges that the programmer and the company conspired for commercial advantage and private financial gain. What a crime. Doesn't every company do that? Isn't that what companies are for? They're supposed to get commercial advantage and financial gain. Isn't that why people go into business?
Yeah, but they don't admit it, though.
Well, yeah, but I mean, this is something that is known. This is what business is for. Business is for making money. Anyway.
It's pretty funny.
Is he awaiting a court date? Or?
That's my understanding of it here. Let me see here. What was it? Defense attorney Joseph Burton said he's been trying to work out a plea bargain. We're hopeful the government would see the wisdom and justice in not pursuing a case against Skilarov, even if one were to ignore the serious legal questions involving the copyright protections. This case hardly cries out for criminal prosecution. Skilarov and Elcomsoft's actions are not conduct that Congress intended to criminalize. And indeed, they should not have... not only not have intended to criminalize it, they should have been legally enjoined from being able to criminalize it, because this is the Congress of the United States. We can't... The Congress of the United States can't pass a law and expect it to be followed in Russia, where an entirely different set of laws falls into place. I mean, anybody who's traveled internationally understands the law changes every time you cross a border. Why can't these idiots that are bringing this guy to bringing this guy to court understand something as simple as that?
It's like if I went to Canada and I smoked a Cuban cigar there, and then I came back here and I was arrested for smoking a Cuban cigar.
Yes, it is exactly what it is like. Actually, kicking around here somewhere.
You'd have had to do it for profit, though.
Oh, that's true.
Like, did you go up there and smoke a Cuban cigar for profit?
Well, I don't know. Well, we'll do more on this border crossing business in a minute, because there is a backlash side to this, which is perfectly predictable, and that's that if we expect countries, if we expect people in foreign nations to obey our laws, it's only natural for them to expect us to obey theirs. Does that not make sense?
It makes sense to me.
Yeah, I know, and this is a very dangerous and slippery slope that we're running into, and I don't want to. I don't want to put myself in the wrong pigeonhole by making claims of national sovereignty, but that's really what we're dealing with here. Anyway,
I think there should be a law of common sense. You know, there should be a common law of common sense, and it should be applied everywhere.
That's a very intriguing idea. Unfortunately, it's an incredibly authoritarian one.
Right, it's my common sense, not your common sense.
I'll come back to this topic.
And your common
in a
sense is not necessarily the views of RPI.
By the way, if you have some common sense that you'd like to contribute, 518-276-6248 is the phone number here at WRPI. The number again, 518-276-6248. I want to hear about people getting upset with the news that I'm bringing you, that we as a group are bringing you. I want to hear that you're upset with it, and I want to hear what you have to say about it. 518-276-6248. Also, if you're too chicken to pick up the phone and put your voice out over our radio station, you can always... Oh, we have a caller. Imagine that. We have two callers even. Hello, you're on WRPI.
Hi.
Hi.
Very frustrating, but then it's the United States and rules don't apply to us that apply to the rest of the world. For example, when corporations go into other countries like in Brazil or in the Amazon bases, they don't have to follow those countries' rules about whatever emissions controls, pollutions, etc., because they're a United States corporation. So it works conversely as well.
I know, and it's a very bad situation. It's not the way that this is supposed to work.
No, but it's our attitude, and it's just yet another example of American unilateralism, and just it's the way we're heading, and it's very scary.
Yeah, I concur. I covered a case maybe 2 months ago or so, somewhere around there,
right,
where a French court expected an American company, specifically Yahoo,
mm-hmm,
doing business in America, to follow French law. I felt that that was wrong. I feel that this is wrong. I feel that the cases that you're bringing up are wrong. Our laws should stop where our border stops, and so should everybody else's.
Wow, that's amazing, because, see, I thought that the United States was the only big spoiled bully of the playground of the world.
I'm sorry, say again?
I think she left.
I think she did, too. All right, we'll bring the next one on then. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to find out what the technology you were talking about earlier was when you were talking about the wireless connections to the Internet. I caught it right in the middle.
Oh, okay, that would be the 802.11 wireless Ethernet technology. Pete could probably fill you in better than I could on that one, although the general overview is that for all intents and purposes, it looks to your computer like Ethernet, but there's no wires connecting things together. You want to talk about it briefly, Pete?
Sure. This article I was reading from was from InfoWorld, and you might be able to get it by searching for Ephraim Schwartz, E-P-H-R-A-I-M. S-C-H-W-A-R-T-Z. But there's a lot of articles about this. 802.11 is, interestingly enough, something that was meant for industrial, scientific, and medical uses, and it's found some other uses like home networking and things like that. Just a couple of standards that are involved. There's 802.11, and the one that is in the article is 802.11b, and that one is really... It's a great one. It operates at 2.4 gigahertz, and it's about 11 megabits a second. And it, unfortunately, there's 802.11b is only one protocol that uses that airspace. There's a couple others, and there's no managed way of deploying it. People can Bluetooth also uses the same space, so. They can conflict, but it's something that the government set aside for people to use without having to buy a license from them. They say, okay, here's some space that you can use to do the things that you need to do that we can't stop you from doing, basically, because we don't want to stop you because you need to set these up ad hoc or at will, and to apply for a license would slow you down. So this is actually a really good thing that we have, and if we use it properly... And if we use it in a concerted manner, then a lot of good will come from it. It's basically a communications method that we have.
Those of us who have a deep familiarity with radio technology and how to apply it are familiar with a part in the FCC rules. It's called Part 15, and basically it's a long laundry list of various bands and modes that you can use. Without requiring any kind of a license, and for instance, you will find at least two sections in there dedicated to cordless telephones. You'll find a section in there, actually three sections, and one of those sections also covers Bluetooth, and it covers 802.11, and it basically lays out the rules under which you can use these bands. So does that help?
It does. Are there corporate applications for this at this point, or just home technology?
Well, if you have a wireless LAN in your corporation or wherever you work, it's probably using the 802.11 protocol or the airspace. It's becoming very common. You can go to basically any computer store and buy a wireless home networking system. And they're pretty reasonable. I think the gateways now are like $150, and a little PC MCI card is maybe $100. And you can get one for every computer that you have.
And I can add to that.
Your neighbor can get one. And
and you can share the Internet connection.
Your neighbor's neighbor can get one.
But I was going to add to that also that the company I work for has been experimenting with 802.11. So certainly there are corporate applications for it.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Absolutely.
You're welcome.
Thank you for calling.
Take care.
Now, I'm wondering, this new technology kind of scares me. It's operating at 2.4 gigahertz. So if you have this this transceiver in a laptop sitting on your lap...
Well, yeah, you are irradiating yourself when you do that, but you're irradiating yourself in the same fashion when you use
a cell phone
yeah. or a certain cordless phones.
Yeah.
It is noteworthy that the 2.4 gigahertz band is the same frequency band that microwave ovens use. However,
right, they gave us the dirtiest airspace available.
Very important to understand. is that the health risk involved in it is actually quite minimal, as the amount of radiation that comes out of an 802.11 card or a cordless telephone that operates on the 2.4 gigahertz band is generally less than the amount of radiation that leaks out of your microwave oven when it's functioning normally. And yeah, it is a noisy, dirty band. There's no question about that.
And it's becoming noisier and dirtier. And actually, it's to the benefit of the large carriers is to make it as noisy as possible, so that in some places you could walk in with a your 802.11 laptop and it won't work because somebody has a Bluetooth device, which some other company sold to the guy next to you, and now they're fighting, and you're like, well, why isn't this working? Well, it would if everybody had agreed to use a common method to use this airspace. So that's something that we need to work on.
Well, the flip side to that one is of course that they have the 802.11 technology as the band divided up into somewhere between 11 and 14 individual channels, depending on what country you're in. I believe in the U.S. it's 11 channels. And any two devices that are on separate channels will not be able to talk to each other. There's a small amount of overlap. Three of the channels don't overlap any of the other channels. So if you have a device on one of those three channels, it won't be interfered with by somebody else's network.
You know, there's another security issue I could think of. If someone wanted to be malicious, they could probably just build a jammer, which would render a whole network inoperable.
Yeah, and I could.
If they wanted to.
Yeah, and I can come in and cut. I could just come in and cut all the wires to your computer, your house too. I mean, there's always a problem.
Well, the thing of it is, they're using a spread spectrum technology, and that's generally considered to be too costly to mount a successful jamming effort against,
mm-hmm.
because the fact that you would have to accurately predict at any given instant exactly what frequency the machine is using at this particular instant and be on that frequency with an equal or greater quantity of power. Otherwise, you have to blanket the whole band, and that just takes too much power to accomplish.
Right. If you were out jamming things, that would be illegal. That would be an illegal activity. It's not illegal to walk up with a competing device, but they will sort out their bandwidth usages as a part of the protocol and start working again. It's mm-hmm. just
right. If you come in with a jammer, that's not going to be an appropriately approved device, because no appropriately approved device will be capable of expending the amount of power over the bandwidth required to adequately jam.
Mm-hmm.
So it would have to actually be a smart jammer. It would have to be able to follow what everybody else is doing step by step as they do it and be waiting for it when it gets there.
Right.
Now, here's an interesting thing. The 802.11a specification is being rolled out by a couple companies, and that's actually operates in just above 5 gigahertz.
Okay.
And that it can handle like 50 megabits a second, and that's very clean space.
Okay. Do need to break this conversation for a moment because we need to stop and do a station identification.
Oh, it's lonely here on 2nd Street and 3rd and Broadway. It gets lonely at night when the one you love is gone. I don't know why she left. I guess it was because I was getting crazy, confusing everyone. Paul Heinrich and Ingrid Bergman and Paris and Key Largo and those strawberries. I just couldn't keep track of everything. But I guess there's only one thing you can do when life gets this crazy, and that's listen to WRPI in Troy, where you could begin a beautiful friendship.
I like clams, they're mushy, they make me feel like a man, they make me feel like a man. I like clams, they're mushy, they make me feel like a man, they make me feel like a man. They have shells that I crack, I find the love within, and I dip them in the butter, and I squish them with my teeth. I get pleasure from the body that I put into my mouth. They make me feel like a man, they make me feel like a man. I like clams, they're mushy. They make me feel like a man, they make me feel like a man. Steamers or cherry scones.
or fried. All guaranteed with joy inside. I like clams.
Farm and clams on WRPI in Troy. The show you're listening to is Little Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter. And I'm going to remind you, since we're at the top of the hour, that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants, not necessarily those of the WRPI staff and management, the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, or the Rensselaer Student Union, or anybody else who may, for whatever purpose, attempt to claim them, although you're certainly free to agree with them if you feel so inclined. If you'd like to contribute your opinion, the phone number here at WRPI is area code 518-276-6248, and I'd like to hear from you. Okay, so where were we?
Using technology with common sense and using it together to our best advantage and, you know, increasing the security, if we can, of each other's lives.
Yeah, well, security is an important... It is an important thing in dealing with a TCP/IP network, regardless of whether it's wireless or not. I've noticed there have been a tremendously large number of hits, for example, on my web server from the Code Red virus, which is making seemingly endless attempts to infect it. And, of course, it's failing miserably because it doesn't run a Microsoft product. But... I've heard from a lot of other people who have been upset about the fact that it's hitting them and hitting them and hitting them and hitting them and hitting them, and this is just the regular internet. This is not any sort of wide open wireless setup.
I was reading on McAfee's site that they probably won't ever really get rid of it. It's just going to be floating out there because there are people who just don't plug up their security holes.
Well, I think users should at some point make a clamor for, you know, why is your ISP delivering the Code Red virus to your to your server? The question needs to be asked. Well, I mean, it's a complicated issue to have to like filter out at the network level and do all those kind of things, because it's just a tangled web as we know it, and it's a difficult thing. So, but at some point you'll have to say to yourself, well, can one ISP provide less viruses to me and less Trojan horses to me?
Here's an idea. Write a program that acts like the Code Red virus, and it jumps around from web servers, but its main function is to plug up the security hole that the Code Red virus is trying to...
That one's been suggested, actually. That's the only problem is, if you do that, does that qualify as an intrusion on your part?
This is true.
Yeah, they might stop... They might stop that one, you know.
Right. I saw an interesting program kicking around, actually, for Linux users, and I've contemplated throwing it on my system myself, but I just haven't gotten around to it. It sits there and it watches to see who is what machines are trying to infect the server with Code Red, and when it receives these hits, it turns around and does a counter hit to verify that the machine in question is in fact infected with Code Red.
Mm-hmm.
Once it's verified, it looks up the administrator's email address in the Whois database and turns around and sends him an email saying, "Hey, your server's infected. Fix it."
Right.
Kind of amusing, I think. Anyway.
Yeah, I've been doing that manually at work each time. I still continue to get that one virus over and over and over again.
Oh, the CIRCAM?
The CIRCAM. and I've been emailing back to people, did you know this is a virus, yada, yada, yakety schmackety. Yeah. And I've actually had people write me back and say, thank you so much, I had no idea.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it runs completely quietly in the background. When we last discussed that that particular virus on air, a caller suggested that maybe an email filter might solve the problem, but the problem is it runs around any email filter that you might have.
Yeah.
I wonder if anybody out there, if any of you guys know, like, what percentage of the gross national product is lost, I mean, basically to this kind of useless effort.
I don't know. Personally, I've been, in a way, I've been kind of enjoying it because of two things. Well, first of all, I have no love lost for Microsoft. And I've been kind of amused by the fact that one of their products could not just go kerflooey, but could go this kerflooey. But secondly, just for kicks and giggles, I went and I put a counter on my webpage that will show you. If you go there, by the way, the address is www.tricityads.com. And before you panic, because this being a non-commercial station, there are no ads on tricityads.com. If you go there and you look, you'll see a counter that shows how many hits the server has taken from Code Red.
If it's non-commercial, can you announce like www.xyz.org, because orgs are generally like not profit.
Yeah, you can. Yeah, well, we can talk about that in a little bit off the air if you want. I mean, we're going to probably take a break in about another 20 minutes or so anyway.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking, like I was saying before about encryption, and encryption should be used just with the idea that, you know, it may be good for your present uses, but just be cautious. And this isn't, if someone said you're paranoid, you could just translate to being realistically cautious.
Yes, be paranoid. A little healthy paranoia is a good thing.
You know, that's what the paranoiacs always say.
I generally tend to have an internet PC and a PC that I work on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's really no question about viruses and intrusion detection.
It's what happens if you have to port large files from the PC you're working on to the internet machine, upload them, or
then you have to go to a media,
or just burn them on CD.
Yeah, burn them on CD or whatever you need to do.
Yeah.
So let's hear your opinions. Area code 518-276-6248. And we're going to move on to another story here. This is one that initiated last week. This was about the whistleblower in Oklahoma who was arrested for he was not arrested. He's been asked to agree to accepting some charges for finding a security hole in a customer's web server. Anyway, Sheldon Sperling, the U.S. attorney in the Brian K. West case, has responded to various email protests on his handling of the case. He claims that West was not arrested and has not been charged. However, an investigation is pending to determine whether West intentionally accessed a computer without proper authorization or exceeded authorized access to access a computer with authorization and to use such access to obtain other information, yada, yada, yada. Second, whether the employee thereby obtained information from a protected computer, and whether the conduct involved in interstate communication. This is from Peter Newman. He says he's noted in the past that where there's no security in place, the alleged culprit cannot have exceeded authority because no authority is implied. As longtime followers of the Risks Digest will recall, this issue came up relating to the trial of Robert Tappan Morris in 1988. He's the Internet Warm author. Let's see here. No authority was required to use the SendMail debug option, to use .rhost mechanism to execute the finger daemon or to read an unprotected encrypted password file, which are all the things that the Internet Warm did. He says, I wonder how and if prosecutors will ever figure this out. As long as we attempt to shoot the messenger and hide lame security behind overly broad laws, weak security will prevail, and whistleblowers will be much rarer than glassblowers. For example, the DMCA is, among other things, an attempt to outlaw whistleblowers.
That's a double-edged sword, though, because like Microsoft products are shipped without virus protection and shipped without intrusion detection and firewall. So if somebody just buys a computer and doesn't really know enough, if they're just a new user, a newbie,
yeah,
and they don't know any better, and somebody comes in and hacks them, is that like they have, they're defenseless in a court of law saying that, you know, I was hacked?
Well, in this particular case, organization should have been liable for the problem, because what happened is they set up a web server with no password.
Mm-hmm.
No password.
Yeah, and this guy just stumbled across this security flaw.
He was their web developer.
He reported it to them, telling them, hey, you better fix this.
Okay.
And then that company pressed charges. I think that's
No. The FBI stepped in.
Or the FBI
and,
stepped
and
in.
And posed as the company. And when he accessed it to demonstrate how it was so easily accessible, that's when he got into trouble.
This guy was just trying to help out, and he was arrested for it. Basically, that's...
Let no good deed go unpunished.
There you go.
That's basically what that says to me. Your opinions. Area code 518-276-6248. Like to hear them. And I think I started to say before, if you're too uncomfortable putting your voice on the phone to over the air, you can also send email. My email address is critter@verizoneatspoop.com. That email address again, critter@verizoneatspoop.com. And I do read all the emails you send, and I respond to most of them. So please feel free to email me if you have something you want to talk about but don't want to talk about it on the air. And we had another story that we brought you last week, and basically we'll bring it to you again because of the fact that it generated such a storm of interest.
Okay, I have it over here. A federal jury on August 21st found Customs Service inspectors intentionally inflicted emotional distress by strip-searching a former Chicago woman at O'Hare International Airport and recommended she be awarded almost $130,000 in damages. The decision isn't binding on U.S. District Judge Rebecca Palmeyer, though she told jurors she would consider their verdict very seriously in reaching her own decision in several weeks. One juror, Roger Smith Sr., described the 5.5-hour deliberation as a dogfight and said the women on the panel were upset that inspectors made Catherine Caniff strip and bend over to see whether she had hidden narcotics in her body. That weighed heavily on the women, Smith said, as she left the Dirksen Federal Building after the verdict Tuesday evening. Prosecutors contended the inspectors were just doing their jobs when they patted down Canis, strip-searched her, and sent her to a hospital for an X-ray after she returned by jet to O'Hare from a 4-day camping trip to Jamaica. Inspectors alleged a drug-sniffing dog alerted on her and that a number of her answers raised suspicions that she might be smuggling drugs. No contraband was found. Caniff, 36, of Washington Island, Wisconsin, wept when the judge announced the verdict of the 4-man, 4-woman jury in the civil trial. Thank God, she said moments later outside the courtroom. I'm just really thankful that they were listening. Those people intentionally hurt me, she said of the inspectors. Maybe they didn't knowingly hurt me, but they really didn't care about me, and that's what I get from this. But in a rare occurrence in federal court, the jury's verdict is only advisory. Caniff's suit was brought under tort laws that don't entitle defendants to who sue the U.S. government to a jury trial, according to lawyers in the case. Both sides agree to hold the trial before Palmeyer and an advisory jury. But the jury didn't know of its advisory role until Palmeyer told them moments before announcing its verdict. Palmeyer asked for legal briefs from both sides in 2 weeks, but set no timetable for her decision. In closing arguments Tuesday, Caniff's lawyer, Paul Schuldiner and Deirdre Bauman, sought $200,000 in damages. Jurors sided with Caniff on all legal fronts, finding that inspectors lacked reasonable suspicion to conduct a strip search, that their conduct was willful and wanton, that they subjected Caniff to false imprisonment, and that they intentionally inflicted emotional distress. They then imposed damages totaling $129,750. Let's see. And Juror Smith said that he was sympathetic with the trauma that Caniff went through, but he also defended the difficult and important job that inspectors must do to keep narcotics from entering at O'Hare. He called the verdict a compromise. The women jurors felt that inspectors should have gone from a pat-down search straight to the X-ray, skipping the intrusive strip search, according to Smith. Some jurors didn't think Caniff's suit was about money, concluding from the testimony that her parents, who attended each day of the 7-day trial, were already wealthy, Smith said. Other jurors also questioned the veracity of the testimony of the inspector who said she felt something in Caniff's crotch area while patting her down, Smith said. They also thought the inspector, Olga Martinez, testified with a smirk on her face, he said. I didn't see it, Smith said. Caniff had testified that Martinez and a second inspector who witnessed the strip search had smirks on their faces after she pulled her pants back up. Prosecutors defended the actions of the inspectors, saying they grew suspicious at Caniff's answers, including that she had paid cash for her airline ticket shortly before her trip, didn't stay at a hotel, and was evasive about who was picking her up. In his closing arguments, Schuldiner, one of Caniff's lawyers, called the inspectors poorly trained, careless, and very aggressive. But during a break in the trial Tuesday, Robin DeSoor, Customs Services Director at O'Hare, said the inspectors acted appropriately and professionally. And I said it last week, and I'll say it again. Now that I know that this is acting appropriately and professionally, I cannot wait to go to work on Monday.
Okay.
And we bend over and strip search, baby.
And we have a caller on the line. Caller, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. You're on.
I just have a quick comment and question about the web developer
that
you
ahead.
Talked about previously.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking that he was apparently searching the web and came upon this site that was...
Well, no, actually, the exact detail is he was a web developer for this particular company.
For the
And what had happened... Well, he didn't work for them. He was subcontracted out. But he was supposed to develop a particular page. Actually, there's a third entity in there. There's the web developer, there's the company he was working for, contracted out, and there's the internet service provider. And the company that had contracted this web developer out also contracted out the internet service provider. And I'm gesticulating wildly here. You'll just have to imagine that part. What happened is he was developing a page for his customer, and what he was going to do is turn around and see how the page would fit into their website. So he went to their website on the internet service provider and hit the edit button on front page. And normally what this would do is it would make a local copy of the, it would take a copy of the page from the web server, put it on his machine, insert his modifications. But instead what happened is it put his modifications on the server.
Okay.
So that was where he discovered that there was a problem.
Okay.
And that was the problem that he was trying to report.
Okay, I misunderstood. What I was thinking was some kind of analogy of somebody is just, you mentioned that there was no password and he notified them. I was just thinking of an analogy, probably wrong here. Someone just walking into someone's home who's not home, the doors are unlocked, and he goes poking around and then calls the owner later and says, hey, you should lock your house up. So I was thinking if it was, and obviously there's an intrusion of property and so forth. And
I hear that analogy a lot with regard to hacking issues. But the fact of the matter is, I hate that analogy. I can't really come up with a better one, but I hate that one.
Well, what's the outcome? The outcome is that someone can walk in your house if your door's unlocked, right?
Well, yeah. And in this particular case, anybody could hook up to that server if they knew what it is. And I don't have it in front of me right now, but I did announce on the air last week what the address was. If somebody were to get a hold of that address, they could go to that server and modify the content based on stuff that is publicly available information, specifically stuff that's being reported in the media.
Okay. Yeah, I just thought he might have been unauthorized to go there, and there was no harm apparently to the company. Is that correct?
All right, I'm sorry to have stepped away for a moment there. I missed your last comment.
Oh, I was just wondering if there was no economic harm or for the company and so forth.
No, actually, there's greater economic harm in leaving it the way it is.
Yes.
Yeah, I think the company gained something by his telling them.
Yeah, and if I remember from the story last week, I mean, the company itself wasn't unhappy with his discovery. You know, they were going to fix it, but the FBI stepped in.
That's interesting.
That's not really 100% clear because, companies are by their nature made up of multiple people and therefore multiple personalities. So one person may have had positive intentions towards the web developer and another had negative ones upon hearing of the security breach.
Mm.
You just never know.
Okay. That was my comment. I enjoy the show. I've only listened a few times, but... I enjoyed it.
Okay, well, thank you very much for tuning in, and thank you very much for calling.
Okay, bye-bye.
It kind of makes me wonder if some of these kind of seemingly minor, or I mean, I don't want to call it minor, but some of these points aren't being pressed by the FBI so that they have some precedences if this ever happens in a, you know, in a situation where they want to...
Well, if the parties that, like, say, the company that had this problem, if they didn't want to press charges, I don't think the government should still press it. They should just back down. There's no one pressing charges.
Okay. Well, we have another caller, so let me bring him on here.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. It's about the strip search.
Mm-hmm.
I can't help noticing in your description of the incident, this horrifying, disgusting incident, that the justification that was given by the customs agents, because it involved suspicion of drug activity, they said that the dog reacted as if there was something amiss.
Yeah.
Right now my point is that's a perfect excuse. You can the dog can't appear in court and say, yeah, you know, the dog cannot be a witness.
Oh,
it's
a perfect
excuse.
Have you forgotten? You forgotten the O.J. Simpson trial?
No, of course I haven't forgotten that. But I mean, I have to try to limit the discussion to the most immediate facts, and they're plentiful, so I don't need to branch out that much now.
I'm going to sidebar here for just a quick second because Lil looks puzzled, and I'm sure there are some listeners out there that look similarly puzzled. Those of you who do not remember, there were some dogs brought in and put on the witness stand in the O.J. Simpson trial.
Purpose? Exactly.
I don't remember exactly.
No.
I'm sorry, caller. Continue.
If the leash don't fit, you must acquit.
Well, anyway, so back to my point. It's say these customs agents, and I'm perfectly... happy to believe that these custom agents just wanted to strip somebody good looking. And, they could say, and I'm sure they sit around talking about this. How can we do it?
Well, yeah,
we blame the dog.
We should really find a picture of her find out.
The dog picked out the best looking woman in the...
Well, they pick it out, and then they do what they want, and then they blame the dog, right? Yeah. Then it's over. It's like the police in the Diallo case saying he was acting suspiciously. Well, he's dead. I mean, so how can anyone prove that he wasn't acting suspiciously? That's one thing. And the other thing was the business of someone else in talking about this raised the issue of reasonable suspicion. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that the concept that was in play for a while, that police could act on the basis of reasonable suspicion, has pretty much gone out the window. There have been a few cases that have gone way up in the courts where the cops acted on a lot less than that, and they got away, and the courts defended it. And the final thing was, the word security.
Mm-hmm.
That this word, it gets thrown around so, it is used so loosely to define anything that supposes that whoever is accusing somebody of violating it wants to protect. They simply say that it was a threat to some kind of security, whether it's the Israeli government, the American government, whether it's IBM or Texaco or the local police, or whoever it is. It's always the security.
The old interest of national security in order to keep something under wraps.
Well, yeah, but that's my point, is that, in that case, it means protecting all the citizens of the United States, right? And that
it should.
Right, whereas when IBM uses it, it means protecting their copyrights and their intellectual property and their monopoly over a technology or the development of it or something like that. When the post office uses it, it means something very different. Or when it's used in reference to a retired person who's getting a government subsidy, Social Security, that means something else entirely different. Or employment security.
Security has got a lot of meanings. One of the things that I ran into at one particular job that I've held in the past was their use of the word security, and their use of the word security meant the system wasn't going to fly apart.
I think you're making a great point. In fact, I should keep in mind that if somebody says security around me, I'll say, you know, can you put an adjective in front of that? Or
that's my point.
Adverb?
Yes, they need to define what they mean by that in the particular instance that it's being used. Because otherwise, people have come to believe that this word has come to embody some concept that people simply accept without thinking. And consequently, it is grossly misused, and it's used to justify anything. I'm trying to think of an analogy, and I'm not coming up with anything. But
yeah, and analogies are sometimes hard to come by.
Right.
They have inherent weaknesses too, which I don't know. Like but, I said, I hate the home analogy with regard to security.
Okay.
But,
listen.
No reason.
Did you see the piece in the Wall Street Journal today about the young fellow that was arrested in Canada for doing something very similar to the case that you were talking about in Oklahoma?
No, I regret that I haven't encountered that one yet. I'll probably stumble on it in the next day or so.
It looks like a carbon copy, and it happened in Canada. It was in the Wall Street Journal today, and he's, I think, 14 or 15. And the very same sequence of events and the very same reaction. So I have it here if you want me to try to get it to you somehow, if you're that interested. But
sure, there's interest.
I can't email it to you.
Cannot email it to me. I'll tell you what. Why don't I...
Can you send it in care of the station? Or?
Yeah, you could send it to me in care of the station if you want.
And you are a little brother?
Yeah, you can send it to care of little brother, WRPI,
uh-huh.
1 WRPI Plaza,
okay,
Troy, New York,
okay,
12180.
All right.
And that goes for anybody else that wants to send me anything if you haven't got access to email as well.
Okay. I know there was something else I wanted to say. Oh, yeah. Can I ask you a quick question?
Yes, you can.
There was a piece also in the Wall Street Journal a couple of days ago in the technology column about, I forget what company it was. I never heard of them. And they have a new chip, one that they've already apparently created, which is not on the market, and another one that's on the runway. The new chip is like way more powerful than the most powerful one on the market, which is the Pentium 4.
Mm-hmm.
This one is like almost twice as powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have a new one that's coming down that's like way ahead of the one that they haven't even marketed yet, because they have to. The piece was about how they have to create a market for it.
Is it a RISC-based processor?
It didn't say that.
Okay. Could it have been American Micro Devices?
No, it wasn't.
Okay.
I might still have that too. I could send that to you. But actually, there's two things about that are interesting. One is the idea that they have a product that they have to create a market for. You know, like the hula hoop,
mm-hmm.
or the pet rock,
mm-hmm.
Or some other. Now, this is not to say that this powerful processor, you know, is as useless as a hula hoop, although who knows, it may well be.
Well,
but the idea that this is classic advertising.
Yes, it is, and I will tell you that for your typical modern user, and mind you, this may not be true in years to come, but for your typical modern user, a processor in the 300 to 500 megahertz range is more than sufficient.
Right.
And they do want to get these higher speed processors out there, because that's how the processor manufacturers stay afloat, is by selling more processors. It keeps the motherboard manufacturers busy too, so they're in on the game as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it keeps the software companies busy, because they then have excuses to use more power in putting more bells and whistles into the software.
It's sort of like convincing people that they need three exercise machines, which they, none of which do they ever use.
They need them.
Well,
they
one
use
for
them.
The abs.
I'm not kidding. You know, I
one
go.
One for the legs.
My job happens to involve going into different people's houses on a regular basis. I mean, lots of houses because I do a certain kind of work.
Are you invited?
Oh yeah, I'm hired. No.
Okay.
Did you tell them they can get rid of all three of those expensive pieces of equipment and just use the ab roller?
But you would not believe how many people have three that they never use.
Yeah.
So anyway, I thought of an analogy of the powerful computer that also that hardly anybody would have a use for is they used to be, you know, back in the days of. When stereos were a lot bigger deal than they are now, the different manufacturers of stereos were always trumpeting their more precision speakers and the turntables that gave you sound reproduction that was more pure, and they had gauges on the receivers and the different components to show you how pure the sound was. The problem is, it was more pure than any human ear could appreciate, but they convinced people to buy them.
Well, I'll tell you, on the subject of purity, we have really, and there are some audiophiles that will argue with you on this detail.
I know.
But we have reached the state of perfection with digital technology. Now, we've backed off a little bit with some of the newer digital technologies, such as MP3, where we've gone to something that is good enough, mm-hmm. but the fact of the matter is the CD... You have reached a level of effective audio perfection because on your CD you can record the entire range of human hearing frequency-wise
mm-hmm.
from 20 hertz to 20,000 hertz and some beyond in both directions, and you can record the entire range of human hearing as far as volume goes because you've got a 96 decibel dynamic range on a CD and on a... Your human hearing, average human hearing, yes, has 140 decibels of dynamic range, but you don't want anything that loud because
right.
it generally leads to your ears bleeding.
Right.
That must be a very frightening point to a marketing person because that proves that people are willing to go from something perfect to something less than perfect and still be happy.
Well, you know, that's why in this piece in the journal they talk about creating the market because people have no reason to think that they have any use for this object. But there was also one final point on that more powerful process that I wanted to ask you about. It was actually the simple question that I wanted to ask, which was in the piece, when it talked about the power of the processor, it used the phrase cycles per second, like 3.2 billion cycles per second. And I'd never heard the term cycles used before. And,
okay.
I'm familiar with operations or bits or computations and whatever. So what is it cycles just a new way?
Let me take a pot shot at that one. It's actually not a new term, but it's actually a very retro term. Back in the 60s, they used to, and earlier, they used to refer to frequencies on radio dial
right.
in terms of cycles per second. Our frequency here at WRPI, it's 91.5 megahertz. We would have been called back then 91.5 megacycles. But it's the same. Was that thunder?
Not here.
Oh, okay. we hear. I just heard some noise that sounded like it was coming over the phone line.
Well, there's supposed to be thunder tonight.
Yeah, that's why I was asking. We're in a basement, so we can't really see what's going on outside. But they basically decided to come up with a name for this unit. It's now called a megahertz. And by referring to 3 billion cycles per second, that's just another term for three gigahertz.
Gigahertz, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm familiar with that concept, the hertz and the cycles and so on.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, if what you're saying is true, it is very... retrograde, is that the term you used?
Well, I just called it retro and left it at that.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that they did that. I wonder why, but, it seems unusually sloppy for such people who are involved in such precision manufacturing, but the only other thing, if I could just mention before I left about the making things that people can't use in reference to hearing recorded music that you can't really appreciate because it's so pure, is that back in the time of the violinist Paganini, have you heard of him?
Yes.
Well, one of, are you also familiar with the famous German poet Heinrich Heine?
That name does not ring a bell.
Well, he was in stature in German culture comparable to Goethe, except that Heine was just a poet and Goethe was everything, a poet, a scientist, and so on.
Okay. Well, we're going to move on at this point.
I'm running off at the mouth. Thanks a lot.
Well, we appreciate the conversation, though.
Okay.
We're going to take a quick break and play some music, and we will return with more of Little Brother shortly.
They were digging a new foundation in Manhattan, and they discovered a slave cemetery there. May their souls rest easy now that lynching is frowned upon. We've moved on to the electric chair. And I wonder who's gonna be president, Tweedledum or Tweedledummer? And who's gonna have the big blockbuster box office this summer? How about we put up a wall between the houses and the highway, and then you can go your way and I can go my way. Records as in a record of an event, the event of people playing music in a room. Now everything is cross-marketing. It's about sunglasses and shoes or guns and drugs you choose. We got it rehashed. We got it half-assed. We're digging up all the graves and we're spitting on the past. And we can choose between the colors of the lipstick on the whores, because we know the difference between the font of 20% more and the font of teriyaki. You tell me, how does it make you feel? You tell me what's real. And they say that alcoholics are always alcoholics, even when they're dry as my lips for years, even when they're stranded on a small desert island with no place in 2,000 miles of our beer. And I wonder, is he different? Is he different? Has he changed what he's about? Or is he just a liar with nothing to lie about? Am I headed for the same brick wall? Is there anything I can do about anything at all except go back to that corner in Manhattan and dig deeper this time? Down beneath the impossible pain of our history, beneath unknown bones, beneath the bedrock of the mystery, beneath the sewage system and the path train, beneath the cobblestones and the water main, beneath the traffic of friendships and street deals, beneath the screeching of kamikaze cab wheels, beneath everything I can think of to think about, beneath all, get out, beneath the good and the kind and the stupid and the cruel, there's a fire that's just waiting for fuel. There's a fire just waiting for you. 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 There's a fire just
Phone lines are open. Take this opportunity to get your call lined up. Area code 518-276-6248. If you want to talk about any of the off issues we've been discussing tonight. Listening to Little Brother on 91.5 FM WRPI Troy. And I had promised earlier to give some discussion to crossing national boundaries with laws. And this next one I have here actually comes from an Australian publication called Australian IT. Businessman Joseph Gutnick has won a landmark court ruling that puts internet publishers around the world on notice that they can be sued under Australia's strict defamation laws and effectively in any of the 190 nations where defamation proceedings can be brought. The Victorian Supreme Court ruled that Mr. Gutnick can sue the world's largest financial publisher, U.S. giant Dow Jones, in his hometown of Melbourne over an article published in the business journal Barron's Online in October of last year.
The article, titled Unholy Gains, described the mining magnet as a devious businessman who was one of the main customers of a jailed U.S. money launderer and tax evader, Nuchum Goldberg. During the hearing, celebrity international lawyer Jeffrey Robertson, QC, argued that the case should be heard in the U.S. because the article was first published in New Jersey and intended for a U.S. audience. But Justice John Hadigan ruled the article was also published in Australia, and the proceeding could not be heard in Victoria, as he had been as had been the law for centuries. In the judgment, he remarked that the case followed this revolutionary technology. Showed that this revolutionary technology at least notably modifies territorial boundaries, and criticized Mr. Robertson for being more concerned with high-minded concepts than addressing critical legal issues. He accused Mr. Robertson of overstatement and making self-indulgent submissions. Dow Jones has already announced an appeal. Mr. Gutnick said from New York that the decision was wonderful news. If they wanted to appeal, good luck to them. They'll just be spending more money, he said. It wasn't easy to sit through those days in court where I was brutally attacked. Victoria is my home, where my family and my football club is. He said the allegations made in the article were false, and it was totally necessary that I defend my good name in Australia under Australian law. While Barron's Online was limited from the world as a whole because it was published on a subscription-only basis, it was still published in Australia as well as in the U.S. Dow Jones lawyer Tim Robertson said outside court that the ruling could set a precedent for cross-border defamation cases to be launched unless laws were changed. This is a very significant decision because it means those publishers who operate web servers, most newspapers around the world do so, are publishing in every country of the world. That means that Dow Jones publishes in Afghanistan, even though it publishes an article which is primarily about business affairs in the United States. Let me take a sidebar here. No, it does not mean you publish in Afghanistan. Afghanistan has banned the Internet. Anyway, to continue. Medical law specialist Andrew Kenyon said Internet publishers should be concerned. People putting stuff online need to be aware that they may be liable anywhere it's received, said Mr. Kenyon. He said Australian publishers who have to meet local defamation laws were at less of a risk overseas action because the laws here are amongst the toughest in the world. From an Australian publisher's point of view, our defamation laws are relatively strict, so if they're meeting our law, they're probably okay elsewhere. Unbelievable.
So what happens if I create a web page that said something bad about an Australian politician? Would I be in trouble with the Australian government at that point?
You better know the laws first.
You know, in order for defamation of character to be considered, doesn't the stuff have to be untrue that they're publishing?
Well, that is actually the plaintiff's claim, is that it is, in fact, untrue.
So somebody has to know the laws of every country in the world to publish?
Well, apparently. That's what it's looking like at this point in time.
Except Afghanistan. But not, they banned the
It's not
internet.
Like they're going to send me to Australia for a trial. It's if I went to Australia. Which goes back to the whole story.
Right, so once you go up to Canada and smoke a Cuban cigar, just don't come back.
I wonder if
it's better up there anyway, eh?
Well, I don't know if it's better or not.
I wonder if Dow Jones Online has some corporate entity that represents themselves in Australia. That's why they can do that.
I don't know. They very well may. That would be about the only circumstances that I can think of where they could possibly do this.
I wonder if you can follow that up. That's an interesting one.
That is. Since you're taking all the notes there, why don't you? Can you scribble something down and just jog my memory? Anyway, this is what I was talking about. Going back to the case where we're charging Russian programmers with breaking U.S. law whilst they are in Russia, and now it appears that Australian businessmen are going after American interests for doing something in America which is legal under American law. This is the backlash that I was talking about earlier, and it's something that we really have to tighten up somehow soon. Otherwise, the whole world is going to go to hell in a handbasket.
I think if I was a lawyer, this would be very interesting to me, and I'd call the show and explain what I know or my opinion on it.
Yes, for all you lawyers out there.
Yeah. I'm not a lawyer. I'm an engineer.
Well, I think that goes for most of us here.
Yeah,
but yeah, I mean, if you have a comment on this, please give a call. Area code 518 877-276-6248.
Are there any lawyers that know the world law, though? Like all the laws of all different countries?
There aren't, as far as I know, any lawyers that know all the laws of our own country. There's too many of them.
This is true. And they change. I mean, someone could make a law in another country just to go after something you're going to do tomorrow.
Well, besides which, in the legal field, you know, you don't, nobody can memorize all the laws. What you do is when you get a case, you research the particular laws on that particular subject. So, you know, consult your books and give us a call.
All right. Well, at this point in time, we are up against the clock. So I'm afraid we're going to have to bring this show, unfortunately, we're going to have to wrap this one up.
Oh.
Yeah, I know. This has been a good evening, and I'd like to, of course, thanks and shout-outs go to all of the people who are listening out there, and especially those of you who have called or emailed.
Shout-outs?
Email us. You can do that. My email address is critter@verizoneatspoop.com, and if you'd like to send snail mail, you can do that. Send it to WRPI, care of Little Brother. No, scratch that. It's Little Brother, care of WRPI, 1 WRPI Plaza, Troy, New York, 12180. So, anyway, that's going to be a wrap for now. For Phil, Pete, and Lil,
thanks
my name is Chuck Ritter.
Goodbye. Thank you.
All right. I'm gonna go to the hospital.